welcome to episode number 78 of The Big Web Show, everything web that matters. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman. Today's show is sponsored by Shutterstock.com, where you'll find over 20 million stock photos, vectors, illustrations, and video clips. Get 30% off any package using discount code BigWebShow11. So thank you, Shutterstock.com. Today's guest is the wonderful and talented Margot Bloomstein. You can find her on Twitter at mbloomstein. She's the author of Content Strategy at Work, Real World Stories to Strengthen Every Interactive Engagement, published by Morgan Kaufman in 2012. And she is the principal of Appropriate Inc., a Boston-based brand and content strategy consultancy. Hello, Margot.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Very good, thanks.
What's it like in Boston today?
It's lovely. It's seasonal, which means it's a little bit chilly, but sunny. So, welcome to the end of November, beginning of the long cold winter.
Yes, 4 months of white hell.
Yeah,
it's cold here too. Cold here in New York too. Cold and gray, not sunny. Sad.
Yeah, that's too bad.
I'm in a room with lights on, which I usually don't have to do, and that's kind of sad. Mm. Let's talk about the book, Content Strategy at Work, Real World Stories to Strengthen Every Interactive Engagement. The second part of the title, Real World Stories, suggests it's a different kind of content strategy book. It's a storytelling approach to content. Yes. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. So my goal in writing Content Strategy at Work was to take all the stories, because I think everybody, you know, we all have our stories about, oh, this project was horrible, or guess what I did on this project that was really smart, and I didn't encounter that problem with that client ever again. We have those stories, and we tell them to our friends. We tell them over beer. We share them at conferences sometimes. Sometimes we get to hear them at conferences if it's a speaker that has that kind of approach to their work and how they share their work. But we don't ever hear them sort of en masse in a way that we can reference them again and again, or bring them to a boss or bring them to a team member and say, here's what worked on this project. This project is similar to ours in terms of its scale or scope or budget or the industry. We should do that too. And so my goal in writing the book was to gather up some of those stories, to go out and research some of those news stories to share. So that it wasn't just the stuff that we share with friends over a beer, but rather something that anybody could reference and say, they did it, it worked, we can too.
So these aren't just these, some of these I assume are your stories, the experiences you've had, but it sounds like a lot of it is work experiences of other professionals.
Yes. Yeah. So my goal in writing it was to kind of gather up that broad collection of stories in a way that people wouldn't look at it and be like, well, that works for them, but that's a big, sexy brand, or, you know, it's fine in their industry. It wouldn't work for financial services, or that's great. They had $1 billion budget. We only have $5,000. I wanted to kind of get rid of all that naysaying, all like the yes buts, by gathering a wide variety of experiences. So in order to do that, I had to look beyond my own experiences. And I do include, I think there's a couple stories in there from my own work, one with a large statewide humanities council, another one with a university based near Boston. I shared some of those experiences, but then I definitely had to reach out to other people because I wanted to hear about how they practiced content strategy for big outdoor retail brands, and how an automotive manufacturer practiced content strategy, and how they do it in state and local and national government, and then also what's going on in other countries too. So there's a lot of other people's experiences.
I'm guessing you have a lot of UX background, because it sounds like personas in a strange way. It sounds like, you know, how should we design this website so it works for Jim, but it also works for Jane? And how's it going to, you know, it's kind of the same thing. How can we design this practice with examples of how it works for, you know, Jim is the marketing director of a billion-dollar sneaker manufacturer.
And yeah. Jane, let's get to know Jim.
And let's get to know this, you know, Jane, who runs this nonprofit and has these concerns. Who did you reach out to get these different stories? How did you find the people and who are the people?
Well, actually, before I answer that, I just wanted to touch on something that you just said as far as kind of that user experience mindset. I guess I hadn't looked at it like that before, but and, you know, they say design is being able to connect disparate things in a way to find that pattern and build on it. I guess that's kind of the user experience thinking here of let's reach out, look beyond ourselves, realize that we are not our users all the time, and instead say, well, who are the people that use content strategy and draw on it? So points to you for that connection, because I hadn't thought of it like that.
Points to me.
As far as like the folks that I reached out to, I guess it's pretty much everybody that I have as a connection in one way or another. You probably got an email from me. It was friends where I knew their work, or I'd been hearing from them about maybe different projects or different clients over the years. And I wanted to say, hey, that time that you were working with so-and-so, can you share that with me again? Can you get sign off so that you can share that with me? In other cases, maybe I had heard a practitioner, Samantha Starmer, had spoken actually at the Content Strategy Consortium a few years ago. So I knew of her from that. I've just known of her over the past few years, gotten to know her better, and a lot of her work then at REI. So I reached out to her to share more of that story. Also, I think in any endeavor like writing a book or simply, you know, progressing through your career, you're always standing on the shoulders of giants and relying on the generosity of people to open up their Rolodexes and share their contacts and share their experiences. So I did reach out to former bosses and employers, reached out to the folks at iSight Design, because I know that they had done a lot of good work with Oregon Health and Science University to share some of that experience from the CMS perspective. So yeah, kind of reaching out to colleagues, friends of friends, and then their various clients to hear about what worked and what didn't always work so well.
Who said no?
I had one agency that I was working with around one of their clients. They had shared a lot. It was a great story. And then at the end of the day, their client said, we don't think we want to participate in this. We don't want to talk about kind of how the sausage got made, which I understand that perspective. And I think sure. For many brands, it's, you know, we don't want to say that we had to turn to an agency in order to get our work done, in order to brand
right.
ourselves.
We're magical.
Yeah. Pay no attention to the agency and the team of elves here behind the curtain.
Right.
So unfortunately, we had to pull that. But otherwise, for the most part, people were very generous.
That's an amazing batting average. Actually, only one refusal. I mean,
there were a couple others. I think also in many cases, people that wanted to share, wanted to be involved, but were just too busy to kind of sit down with me for coffee or to get on the phone or that type of thing.
How did you present it? Said, I'm doing this research for a book I'm writing, and this will make your company look good, or
so I guess I'll let you in on a little secret of my approach, my agenda, I guess. Though I wanted to share stories that I felt were good and representative, when I had the opportunity to maybe share the perspectives from different brands or different, I guess mostly from different brands, but I had the opportunity to maybe spotlight one brand that I felt was particularly socially responsible, or that maybe a nonprofit whose work I champion, as long as they were still a good example of content strategy and helped me tell the story, I went with those organizations that I would also be able to give them a little bit of free PR. So that's always a nice opportunity too. But yeah, I guess when I was reaching out to those different brands as well as to different colleagues, it was to say, I'm working on a book to tell how content strategy affects different organizations and different people in those organizations who aren't content strategists. In other words, the copywriters, the designers, the project managers, the SEO folks, the social media folks, the IAs.
So that's who you're writing for.
Yeah, that's who I was writing
for. This is not a content strategy for content strategists book.
No, many of them seem to be picking it up and referencing it and using it, which I love, and I want them to keep doing that. But I was writing it for all of our peers and colleagues, because I think it's one of those things where, you know how they say like the door to power opens from the inside. In other words, people that are already in a place of respect, they have the opportunity, and maybe the onus is on them, to bring other people up to the table, whether that's to invite other people onto the stage, onto the podium, or if it's to simply say, yes, we already have the respect of our clients, we here with all the budget on the project, but let's bring other people to the table that will enrich this process as well. I wanted to reach out to those people that already have the budget, have the respect. I mean, designers have gone through this process already. Information architects and user experience consultants have gone through the process of saying, here's what we do, here's why it's of value, here's how it can help make this experience better. And in large part, their clients trust them with that. For content strategy, that's been, I mean, we're kind of the newest kids to the table.
Right.
People have been practicing content strategy with that name, in teams of that name, for well over 10 years. And I guess I put that out as a marker because I know when I first started working in content strategy, I was hired into a team with that title. And I was working with folks that had already been practicing content strategy for many years before I got there.
Who was doing that? Because it seems to me, and I think to a lot of, I can't speak for a lot of people listening to the show, but I think in the design world, content strategy like seems like a fairly new thing, like the last 4 years. Christina Halverson didn't invent it, but she sort of made us all aware of it. You're saying it goes back further.
Yeah, definitely. I think as long as people have been producing content, maybe just calling it copy and forgetting that there was visual and audio stuff as well. But as long as people have been creating content, maybe not just on their own, but with a team of other people, and then having those, oh my gosh, moments of, wait, we have to get more of this stuff. Where's it going to come from? How are we going to be getting it? Can we pull it from other sources, aggregate it, translate it for tone? All of those types of issues. And then having presented in an organized fashion, there's been content strategy going on.
In the digital world, because I don't think there's been content strategy in the, like, say, in the newspaper or magazine world, has there?
Yes, there has. And okay. I can certainly also, hold on 1 second.
Is that your dog?
That is my dog. Let me just usher him out of the room a moment.
Okay. Listeners, we're just going to keep this real time. We're not going to, la, la, la. We love dogs. Dogs
okay.
are good.
We don't cut. That's fine, too. For everyone listening at home, that was Ringo. Kind of upset because I think the mailman is getting close to the house.
Okay. It's so interesting. So you're in a house. I'm in New York, but all the noise is coming from the house in the in a little garden somewhere. It's interesting. Okay. So you're saying, okay, so you're correcting my vast ignorance here. I did. So really there have been content strategy professionals at Esquire and People in Ms. Magazine all these years?
Yeah, I think the editorial process in many ways overlaps with content strategy.
They didn't call it that.
It's the same way as in the world of exhibit design. I've done a lot of research into that area for different presentations and to kind of confirm some different things that I was suspecting and all. And in the world of exhibit design, they go through many of the same processes that we do in content strategy as far as figuring out what's going to be the theme of an exhibit. Maybe that takes the form like of a message architecture. Where are we getting content then that can uphold this theme? Maybe they'll do a content audit, prepare a content inventory, and then how are we going to keep rotating new content into this over time? So maybe there'll be an editorial calendar behind it. They may not use those labels for it, but we certainly can draw on that kind of history and process. And so, but 10 years ago, when I was joining the team and the profession, it was in a digital agency. It was in Sapient in Boston. So I think content strategy was happening in those larger agencies along the coasts in New York and in Boston and San Francisco. As I said, I joined a content strategy team and with that title. At times, yeah, it was glorified copywriting. But I think over the past decade plus, we've been able to professionalize that, harden some of those processes. Right. 3 years ago at the Content Strategy Consortium, that entailed folks getting together to say, okay, we're all using this term. What does it include? What do we actually do when we say we're doing this, when we offer this service? What does it not include?
And, so you're and what having kind overlap? Of, you're having the same kind of conversations they often have in the UX community where they'll have a conference and half the sessions are about what are we and what do we call ourselves and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that still happens in the UX community. I feel like in the content strategy community, we've largely tabled that.
You've done it.
There's still, I'm not going to call them debates because I think that we tend to be more, maybe more constructive and collaborative than that in how we're refining parts of the profession. But certainly there's folks that delved into it on their blogs and in different articles to discuss it more to say, okay, well, how can we continue to fine tune this? But I don't think they're quite as contentious, maybe, as you see in other industries and communities.
So at one time, let's say 15 years ago, magazine and newspaper publishers thought of there was the canonical place for the content, which was their magazine. And then some of it got shoveled onto the web or some of it got siphoned onto the web. And they didn't really, there wasn't a digital first mindset then at all. And of course, in some places there still isn't. But as a content person, we've got, you know, TV media, we've got all kinds of media now. Some people say converging. Would you say that content is mostly now coming from the digital team first and finding its way out toward specific media? Is stuff just coming from a content team first and squeezing itself out toward, you know, some goes to digital and some goes to, but are companies reorganizing? This is a really crazy question. Are companies organizing themselves around content more now and seeing content as more of its own thing and less of a specific medium first?
Sure. I'm not good at talking just in theory because I immediately go to, and I don't want to make the mistake that the plural of anecdote is not data. I immediately go and think about, that's not original to me, but I immediately think about other examples of clients with whom I work and organizations that I know and trust friends and colleagues with their content. And I think, well, they'd like to do it like that. They'd like to have all the content emanating from one central digital source, one think tank. But, you know, they've got the legacy politics and, right, and departments, and they've got some that's being produced centrally and some that's coming out from like their different sort of people on the street and field offices and whatnot. I work with one organization that I actually work with them on more of like a print basis, where it's a multinational company and they're pulling in content, both quasi-finished content as well as content ideas from their different counterparts around the world. And we come together to produce a magazine, an internal magazine together every 3 months or so. And in that process, content is coming from lots of different places. We centralize it and standardize it, and we're moving towards structuring it better so that it can then be disseminated. A lot of it goes back into that print publication, but then it also allows their different international counterparts to draw on it for their own use and kind of push it out to other channels. Over the coming months, We'll be looking more at, well, how can we use this content also so that it's more applicable for external audiences, more applicable for publishing on Facebook, maybe as a wall post, as well as in a tweet? Can we communicate the same information just through a photo gallery? Again, that would just be online. So that's a case where it's kind of a print. I shouldn't say it's a print-driven process. It's still a team that is focused on print. We're all kind of gathered together to produce a print publication. But then it's going out to lots of different endpoints.
If you're right now, if you have, you know, copy and decks and leads and headlines, but you're going to eventually move to a more multiplexed publishing model, you're going to eventually move from blobs to chunks, mm-hmm. to use Karen McGrane's.
Yes.
How do you get from decks? What's your roadmap with your clients for getting from headlines and decks and copy to chunks? Or you don't even need a roadmap. It kind of does itself. I mean, a deck is a chunk.
No, I'm not going to say it does itself, because I think that's the mistake that we've long made about content happening in the passive voice, that it'll be done. No, I mean, it takes some heavy lifting. Like, there'll be the more tactical parts of the process that will probably involve templates and breaking them down and then pushing the content then back out into spreadsheets to diagram. I mean, it's kind of like the old style of diagramming sentences, but instead we'll be diagramming those chunks and looking for ways to standardize them to say, okay, every time we write an article, it is made up of these constituent parts. An article type comprises, you know, a headline, a subhead, a pull quote, a photo, whatever. And that'll be fine.
Each of those elements can be reused in other fashions. Each of those is a kind of chunk.
Right. And that's the tactical stuff that I think that content strategists know how to do, because we've done it before. You can do it in many different media. You know, that's stuff that the magazines have to wrestle with, as well as museum exhibit designers. And you can read about it and find templates online and all those types of things. But I think then there's that other side that's, we can call it like more softer skills, but it's still very much a part of content strategy. And that's dealing with the people that create that content, the politics and the weird fiefdoms and messiness. And people might feel like, well, wait a second, I've always been in charge of the HR content, like talking about employee anniversaries. Why is that not still mine? Why am I still, why am I only in charge of some things now and not others? So that's the tougher stuff, but I think that's very much a part of content strategy too.
And sometimes that's always the toughest stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it's part of design too.
Right.
The people need to feel listened to, and well, this is, why aren't I in charge of this? I know more about our customers than anyone else. Why isn't anyone asking me? And so you have to ask them and.
Yeah.
All that.
Yeah. And I mean, I think like the very tactical and technical stuff can plan for. We know how to engineer, so to speak, for the needs of different software. But it's the wetware, the people, that's the tough part.
Yes.
The part that I think is very much a part of content strategy.
Is that in your book? So when you talk about real world strategies, are you not only in the book addressing the software, but are you also addressing the wetware? Some of the stories about handling tough personal problems, because I think that's the hardest thing for a lot of us. I mean, a lot of us are good at learning a theory or learning a, you know, a process, but it's much harder to sell people on a good idea or persuade people without making them feel like we're shoving something down their throats. Does content strategy at work, real world stories, etc., address that?
Yeah, we have to address that. I had to address it in the book, because if for things to really succeed, both in the stories that we tell about them as well as in the work we do, we have to take into account the people that make them that make it all happen. In the different parts of the book, it's basically organized. Every chapter is devoted to sort of a different target audience, I guess I'd say. And so there's a chapter for designers, a chapter for IAs, a chapter for project managers. And I approach it from both the angle of, if you're a content strategist that's trying to make this case to a project manager, try these different points of entry. And also, if you're a project manager, here's what you should be asking your content strategist. Or if you can't hire a content strategist and there's not one on the team, you need to be thinking about these things and approach them in this way. And toward the end of the book, we get more into, okay, now here's how to counter the arguments against some of that stuff. So if you hear someone say, well, we don't have budget for strategy, or we don't have time for strategy, maybe this is what they're really worried about, and instead dig into it in this way. So I do get into those issues. And I think kind of going back to that bigger issue of just dealing with people, a lot of it is how we guide and mentor and present what we're doing, because content strategy is change at a very basic level. And I tell this every time if I'm working with a more design-driven team, and or when I've worked with like an account manager that's come back and said, they're not interested in new content. We just need a new look and feel. Mm-hmm. I don't hear that as much now, thank goodness. But, you know, whenever I've heard, I always think, well, we wouldn't be going through, if it's, say, a website redesign, we wouldn't be doing that unless we wanted to communicate something different, something that we're doing now. Maybe in having just a website, or not having an app, or in having the experience that we do, something that we're doing now isn't working well enough, so we need to change it. And if we need to communicate something different, that means we probably have different communication goals, so different message architecture, maybe different style and tone, those types of things. Maybe we need new content types. That all points to change, and change is hard because sometimes it means people on the team, like the marketing team on the inside, has to take on new responsibilities. Maybe they have to hire new people. Maybe they have to push people that have been there a long time out of their roles or into things that are not as comfortable. And nobody likes that, but I think that's why we have to have those tough conversations, because it's not about preserving people in their roles. It's about creating better opportunities for communication.
You talked earlier about selecting people in your companies and people in the book who do a good job of bringing others into the fold, bringing others into the conversation. So you're sort of rewarding companies that you feel are ethically, you know, tend toward diversity, I suppose, or tend toward, you know, promotion from within, or something along those lines. You also do a lot of mentoring yourself, or you're very interested in mentoring. Can you talk about that at all? And, you know, and
sure,
how you see that in the industry, where the importance of that?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I guess I would say when I was choosing companies, if I had the opportunity to choose between one that seemed more socially responsible and one that wasn't quite as so, then I would choose the one that I felt was just a more ethical company. But as far as mentoring goes, and kind of broadening the fold, bringing more people to the table, that's something that I think is really core to our profession. And when I say our profession, I don't mean just content strategy, but I think more broadly design and user experience, simply because we're not an industry or a profession that has always had clear career paths and clear academic routes from which to pursue those career paths. I mean, I know in my own background, I went to a really small high school. There were 800 kids K through 12. Somewhere along the way, somebody said, hey, you might want to study design because it's like art that you can make money at. And I still remember that. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, okay, that sounds great. You know, because here I loved figure drawing. Why not get paid for it? I didn't know what I was doing. So I kind of went into the right, it ended up being the right college major for me for all the wrong reasons. But from that background in design, I studied design at Carnegie Mellon. And from there, I moved into content strategy. Because when I graduated, actually like senior year, when I was interviewing around and whatnot, I interviewed at Sapient and a number of other places. And in one of my interviews, they were asking me, okay, well, how would you approach this design problem? And before I could offer ideas or answers around typography or the layout of information or anything like that, first I was saying, well, what do we know about I don't think I used the term content, but I think I said, well, what do we know about what the client wants to communicate? who's their target audience? What are they already using to communicate that? Do they have, like, can we reuse existing copy and all? And basically in the course of the interview, the folks that I was meeting with said, they laughed and they said, that's great, but that's not what we do. But you should interview with this other team at the company. So they pointed me in the right direction. And I think
the design team didn't do that.
The design team at the time focused, and I'm trying to remember if this is
maybe they were more of an interface design team. They focused more on buttons and transactions.
More visual, not really concerned so much with, like, well, where's the content coming from? They worked around a lot of lorem ipsum.
But it's not just content. I mean, you're talking about what does the client want to convey? Why are they doing this? Why are we making a web? What are we making? Is it an application? Is it a website? Why are we making it? What's wrong with what they had? What new thing? Like, you were asking questions I think every designer should ask. Why? I mean, every time someone wants to hire me, my first question is why? I try to talk them out of it, which sounds stupid and weird and counterintuitive, but it's like, are you sure? Maybe you don't really need a new design. Because you know, you really want to know that you're doing something meaningful, and it always comes down to content and the change in audience and all that. So I'm surprised that they didn't. So you went right from Carnegie Mellon, by the way, kudos, very good school, hard to get into.
Thank you.
Hard to get into. You're not from Pittsburgh originally.
I'm not. I'm from upstate New York, but Pittsburgh was an amazing place to go to school. I'm a big fan of Pittsburgh.
Yeah, me too. So did you live in around Carnegie Mellon and, you know, in Oakland or something at the time?
I lived. Well, the campus is between Oakland and Squirrel Hill and
Shadyside.
And I lived on campus there for a couple of years and then a little bit off campus for my final 2 years there. And I love going back to Pittsburgh, like for Web Design Day. Val and Jason had done an amazing job putting that together. Mm-hmm. And I had the opportunity to speak at it a couple of years ago. And it was such a great opportunity to also go back. And like I ran to the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. I'd worked there one summer in school. So it was great to go back there and to some of the great restaurants. Everybody, I think, needs some time going to Pittsburgh because it so grounds you. Definitely in our profession. It's just such an amazing city.
But you went into Carnegie Mellon not for the computer program.
Not human, right. Yeah, the human computer interaction
right,
program.
No. Figure drawing. Figure drawing.
I had a lot of figure drawing in my portfolio going in, and then I think it was kind of like a studio art background that I was coming from
in high school.
Yeah.
And how did you have a studio art background in high school in America?
I had just taken a lot of art classes. I think when the opportunity was up there to pop in another elective, mine was usually in the art room.
Me too. Do you miss that now? In all the years that you've been doing content strategy, do you miss? Do you
making
still,
things?
Yeah. Do you draw? Do you paint?
Yeah. I draw a lot. I don't work a lot. I've usually worked just in two dimensions. I'm not really good at three dimensions. I do still draw a lot. And actually, I guess kind of in the realm of three dimensions, I took a glass blowing class a few months ago and revisited it recently. And that was just fabulous. And also I shoot a lot. I do a lot of photography. So that's kind of kept me more in touch with just seeing and watching and experiencing the world. Cause I do think that's important as kind of working as a user experience practitioner. The basis of our work is really empathy for somebody other than who we are, to
absolutely
be able to design for the other. Yeah. And if you don't have that empathy, if you haven't spent time seeing what other people have to deal with, whether it's when filling out a form or, negotiating like a difficult, overly steep staircase, how can you possibly create for them? Why would you want to create for them? So I think that art gives me that opportunity.
I always think that the most important thing a designer needs more than aesthetic taste or huge knowledge of typography or all that. The most important thing they need is sensitivity to others, empathy. And if you don't have that, you can't really, you can maybe have a great style and design a certain kind of thing, and people can hire you to design that thing. You're frowning. Yeah. Our listeners can't see that you're frowning. But Do you mistype?
I don't miss it.
I mean, you miss. You work with it.
Yeah, I still work with it. I mean, I had 3 years of typography classes when I was at school. Christian Schwartz, who's since gone on to work for the Font Bureau.
Yes.
He was one of my teaching assistants.
Teaching assistant?
Yeah, he was a year ahead of me in school.
Christian Schwartz was a teaching assistant a year ahead of you in school.
Yes.
Amazing. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I think that really gave me an appreciation for type.
Yeah.
And still today, I mean, I think whenever I have to send in a document, whether it's like a proposal or something like that of my own design, I'm definitely spending a lot of time first figuring out, well, what are the right typefaces to communicate?
Absolutely.
And then let me figure out what's the word. So it's
let me ask you this. Morgan Kaufman, your publisher for Content Strategy at Work, Real World Stories to Strengthen Every Interactive Engagement. I love saying that. Morgan Kaufman. Did they force you to type in Courier 12 or something when you submitted your... Because some publishers really have a template they want you to use. I won't mention names. I published with New Writers, and mm-hmm. They don't have it. They let me do... I basically said I have to write this in the typeface that the book is going to use. Otherwise, I can't write this. It was like I needed to see the words in the typeface they were going to be in the book. Otherwise, I can't write in Courier. I can't use IA Writer. You know, a lot of people love that. A lot of people love it because of its minimal design and everything, and that's great. But I can't. You know, I have problems when a tool forces me to do anything.
Yeah, basically. I mean, I think I wrote it. I just wrote it straight out in Word and then brought it into Courier. I think I'm able to sort of separate the left brain, right thing enough that when I'm trying to communicate in blunt sentences and active voice, I don't have to be just writing in Clarendon. I am able to kind of to make that shift to something that's, you know, a little bit more neutral or even maybe a little bit more lyrical maybe. Yeah, I mean, for writing the book, yeah, it did live through its Courier phase. I will say, though, then when we started working on the template for it and kind of looking at it in the layout, I think that and if my editor is listening, they'll probably be nodding their heads fiercely there. But I probably pushed back more than most authors in terms of the overall, or most authors that they're used to working with in terms of the overall look and feel. And they were very accommodating for that. But I think the fact that my audience includes designers meant that we couldn't just be setting it, it with like full justification, because I knew that that was going to be doing horrible things to the copy and creating like weird rivers in it and all. Mm-hmm. And so it needed to be set a certain way. And that was definitely a bit of a struggle, but the typography in it really mattered to me because what I was communicating really mattered. And my audience, including designers, mattered to me. So I wanted to give them something that was conducive to a good reading experience.
Boy, I completely relate. And I think it's important. And I also think, again, the soft skills, the people skills come into play, because there's a way of doing that that gets everyone on board. And they say, oh, this author wants to make sure it's the best possible product for her audience. And there's another way of doing that where you're a prima donna and you don't know anything about business and you don't know understand publishing and you should just shut up and leave them alone. And obviously, both of us were able to, as far as we know, not offend people and still kind of get what we wanted. So I think that's the hardest thing in all of this is just, you know, and I guess listening too, because sometimes they're right. It's really important to know when they're right. Another big thing you do in terms of community and giving back and mentoring, you run a meetup, right? The Content Strategy New England meetup. What's that like?
Yes.
How did that start?
Started a few years ago. Rick Allen and I, along with Matt Grocki, Georgie Cohen does a lot. Samantha Snedhow has done a lot. We help. We work together, I guess, to run this group, the Content Strategy New England Meetup. And And it's wonderful because every month or two, we bring in different speakers. Or if we can't get a speaker that month, then we'll do just more like a show and tell evening where people bring their work for feedback or to show maybe how they've solved a particular problem with a client or a content type. And it's really bred a wonderful community. We have a few hundred members. Most recently, actually just earlier this week, we hosted David Hobbs. He's in Boston right now for the Gilbane conference. And he was talking about preparing content for web migration. So we've hosted speakers talking about more CMS driven issues, editorial style and tone, Mandy Brown, Aaron Kassane, Colleen Jones, Christina Halverson, David Hobbs. It's been a good variety of speakers. And then at different times, we also like to focus it a little bit for different industries. So Rick Allen and Georgie Cohen also coordinate Meet Content, M-E-E-T content. I'm always like, come on, guys, let's talk about like a rump roast or something. But it's called Meet Content, and it's for the higher ed community and talking about content strategy issues there. And
wow.
So, yeah.
How responsive is that community, and how is that? How's that going? They have a lot of challenges in that community.
A lot of challenges, also a lot of great thought leadership. Yep. And a lot of daring people in their different organizations, whether Yep. they're big, well-funded schools or much smaller liberal arts colleges. There's a lot of good stuff going on out there. And they all seem very good and collaborative at sharing what they're doing. So it's a vibrant community.
Nice.
So working with them, we also hosted more of the higher ed driven content strategy meetup several months ago now, and heard from more folks in that community. So it's wonderful. And I think that spirit of creating community and encouraging community, that fits in really well, I think, with the mentorship. We were talking about it a little bit earlier. I think that because we have a young industry, it's incumbent on all of us to reach out to other people, whether it's students in high school or in college, to say, hey, this is a viable career path. Here's what you should be thinking about and studying now. Here's how you move into this career path. So my big thing is I love speaking in college classes, guest lecturing, that type of thing, and saying, okay, my background, maybe if it's for a bunch of designers, is to say, well, my background is in design as well. I decided I didn't want to just be working with that kind of traditional career path instead of just solving problems typographically and by determining image composition and the density of layout on the page. Instead, I wanted to solve them through style and tone and content types. So that's why I pursued a path in content strategy. And sometimes, you know, there's a few kids in the class that are like, tell me more. And that's an exciting thing. It doesn't require a lot of time. It isn't a huge investment on my part, but it kind of gets them on that path. Other people I know are good at offering internships also to help students explore those opportunities. And I do think it goes back to that idea that, okay, those of us that are working in the field now, it's kind of a selfish thing, but if we want more smart people to work with in the future, people that, you know, I want to be able to work with designers that aren't like, content strategy, what's that? You're just going to steal my budget. Or, yeah, we'll worry about the content later. I don't want to work with those people. I want to work with people that say, I've heard about this, or tell me more. Let's work on this together. Let's collaborate on it. And that makes a better experience, certainly for me, and I would hope for them. But it also makes a better end product for our users and for our clients. So I think, we need to kind of start that process of those conversations and whatnot. We need to start that early.
Wonderful. Well, I want to thank you very much. If people are more interested in other things in the book, they can go to appropriateinc.com/book. If they're interested in the consultancy and you generally, appropriateinc.com. You are M. Bloomstein on Twitter. Is there any other URL folks should have handy?
No, appropriating. That's where the blog, the book, speaking, all of that stuff.
I want to thank our sponsor today, Shutterstock.com, where, again, You'll find over 20 million stock photos, vectors, illustrations, and video clips. And I really want to thank you, Margo. You're wonderful, and you've written great stuff here and at Elistapart and Contents Magazine. And it's a pleasure to finally meet you, and I hope we'll speak again soon.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
Take care. Thank you.